tune off the beat, south the beat, north where I'm from, Virginia, of course, south the beat, north the beat, south what it's like, hey yo, it is what it is, yeah, hey yo, what it is, hey yo, what it is, what it is, it couldn't be nothing else, we brought down place off, all the satellites, Bill Wings,
Serge, can you hear me?
I can.
Just want to make sure you're still available.
Yeah, oh, I'm totally available. I'm just sitting here fucking. As a matter of fact, this keeps me from mowing my lawn, which is what I was doing in the middle of mowing my lawn, and I'd much rather be chatting about stupid 90s awesomeness than mowing my lawn right now. So thank you.
Yeah. You know what's even more embarrassing for me? I've never actually mowed the lawn.
Oh, I'm so envious.
And I grew up in the suburbs.
Dude, mowing the lawn blows. It's fucking horrible. It's sweaty out here. I've developed allergies now that I'm an old man. I fucking have to wear, like, I get fucking hot as shit out here. I'm sweaty as hell. I'm wearing a fucking set of coveralls. It's fucking horrible.
Are you still on the East Coast?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm still outside D.C.
Nice.
Yeah.
Are you originally from the area? Are you?
Yeah. I was born in D.C. Proper, but grew up in the burbs.
Which burbs did you grow up in? If you don't mind my asking.
In Vienna.
Vienna.
Yeah,
sweet.
Vienna, and then I lived in a huge place and was out in Arlington and in Alexandria. Primarily.
Yeah, I didn't know if you were a DC proper guy or if you were a Virginia guy, you know, per se.
I am a Virginia guy who ran away into the city to do everything I could to not be in the suburbs.
Well, that's what we were all trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, as much as possible. It just wasn't always easy to get out of the suburbs.
It was pretty easy for me. Well, thankfully, like, we had the metro right there and, you know, just split.
Yeah, you guys had the metro then in Vienna.
Yeah.
At that point for us, the metro hadn't come out to Reston yet.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, you had to actually drive to the metro to get on the metro, which somewhat defeats the purpose of.
Well, no, because you had the bus too. Like, I think a lot of folks kind of dismiss the bus as being useful, but like the guy Mike Palmedo, who played bass for the Goons, like, he was from Reston, and you know, he just lived on the bus, you know, like, take the bus into the closer suburbs and get on the train with us or whatever, but yeah.
Well, I should have gotten my bus schedules down a little bit better. And if I had,
there's always.
And if I had, then I wouldn't have missed out on a lot of DC stuff that I'm kind of hearing about now.
Wow.
Unfortunately.
Well, at least you didn't have to feel the pain of missing out while it was going on, yeah. All my friends are downtown, and I'm here playing such a video game, so this is bullshit.
So when did you actually start playing music?
I think when we were 17, me and the group of kids that I hung out with in Vienna, you know, most of them played some instrument or another, and we just, you know, we wanted to do something, so we just started doing something. And we ended up playing, I remember we played a show at like a community center in Falls Church for a bunch of teeners and stuff, and we got paid $50, and we were just, you know, woo!
Yeah, that's
tons of
cigarettes. That's exciting. You even got paid for it.
Yeah, it was amazing. Unexpected.
That is amazing back then. Was that with the Goons, or were there other bands prior to that?
It was, I don't even remember what it was called, now that you asked, but it was just a handful of dudes. I think one of the guys, I think Mike Palmetto might have been involved with that too, but I don't even remember exactly.
Reston guy Mike Palmetto.
Yep.
I heard he spends a lot of time on the bus.
He does. Indeed.
So what was the scene like back then in high school for you?
The scene for us in high school, I guess, really, you know, for me, it's centered around the old 930 club and, you know, what was going on in Reston. Like, because there were no other punk bands around. And then, you know, Mike turned me on to some of the older Reston stuff that I never got to see. And then we started going to Jam for Man. And that was, you know, a huge, like, these are young kids, like, not much older than us, who are making music that sounds like music, right? It doesn't sound like some slop together fucking bullshit. It doesn't sound like, you know, the school band all out of tune and out of whack. Like, they sound like real music, and people are fucking loving it, and, like, tons of people would come out. And so, yeah, like, it pretty much, that's kind of what we did, is go to the 930 Club, go to Jam for Man, you know, or go hang out in people's basements, listen to records.
What were the bands at Jam for Man that got you most excited or inspired?
The first Jam for Man I went to was the one that was held out on the track at the high school. Then I remember seeing Avail there for the first time and being really, you know, blown away. They were a very different band back then.
Beating in time, slid by it. Like a waterfall, we just can see it all. I want the rain to come down and wash away.
Who else played? I think Remission played, and they were great. And then we would go to Jam for Man, and we would see, oh God, who else would play? My God, I saw Brothers and Branch Manager, some band called Stunt Monkey, which is a horrible name, Sun Monkeys. Yes, thank you. I remember seeing Sun Monkeys there, Crunchy Water, which, you know, whereas they played well, wasn't exactly what I was into, but it was still cool. Yeah, I saw Avail a few times, if I recall, at the community center shows. I mean, it was really a social thing, too. Like, that was a place where, gosh, you know, there's all these other weirdo punk kids from all over these suburbs that I don't see anywhere else, and suddenly, you know, there's 150 of them all packed into this community center, and I'm like, wow.
And what were the bands when you were going into DC and you went to the 930? Like, what was the first band that just blew you away?
I wasn't really going to the 930 Club so much to see locals as I was going to 930 Club to see, like, Fear, when Fear did their first reunion tour with, like, the original members. And I saw 7 Seconds there, and God, who else? Fuck, Man or Astro Man, and stuff like that, like GDH.
Yeah.
it was more national acts that I was going to see there.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. I kind of wanted to find out, you know, who your inspirations were, or what was the music that was influencing you?
Oh, yeah, definitely Fear a lot. And then when I got to college, I discovered bands like the Dwarves and New Bomb Turks and things like that. And we were going to see them a lot. And then when I moved back from college, the Suspects were playing here in D.C., and somebody turned me on to them. And they were the first band, or I guess they were the second band in D.C. that I had seen that I felt compelled to do my absolute best to go see them every time they played, because, you know, they just had this certain energy that worked for me, that, you know, moved me to fucking go ape shit and have a good time.
Did you go to college in the area, or did you go away to school?
I went to VCU for a short time, and down there I discovered the Candy Snatchers, who were amazing. I don't know if you're familiar with the Candy Snatchers, but they were a huge, huge influence for me. Like, I saw them play at Twisters, and I had not heard of Gigi Allen yet, and I'm sitting at the bar, and I have a blue mohawk, and this weird biker guy who is up front, like, going apeshit with, like, long hair and a beard and stuff. He comes back to buy himself a beer, takes one look at me, and kind of grabs me by the T-shirt and drags me up to the front of the stage, and he finishes his beer, hands the bottle to Larry May, who's the singer for the Candy Snatchers, who at the time he had like a very nice haircut, and he had a nice white button-up shirt on, and he had some acid wash jeans and what, like, I assume like some penny loafers on or something, right? And he took that bottle and he broke it on the bass drum and he stabbed himself in the head with it, and he just started gushing blood all over the place. And, you know, I had never seen anything like that before, and it fucking was amazing. We'll be right back.
Sounds pretty punk rock.
It was pretty tough, man. Like I said, like, I was 19, and I was like, holy shit, yes, this is good. this is what I'm supposed to be right now.
Yeah, it's good stagecraft, too.
Mm-hmm.
You go along with, you know, the button-up shirt.
Oh, yeah.
And the penny loafers and stuff. You're not really expecting that.
Not at all. Not at all. I didn't even know what to expect. Like, one of the guys that I was in the dorms with, he was like, this band's amazing. They're from Virginia Beach. I'm from Virginia Beach, in my hometown, and you got to come check it out. And he was not wrong, man.
So were you in art school at VCU?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so you're also a visual artist?
No. Well, I mean, I was. I kind of gave up on all that a long time ago. I kind of lost the patience for it. I think maybe I don't know. I don't even know how to explain the, sorry about that, the train.
Oh, no, that's cool.
It's just, yeah, okay, there we go. I kind of gave up on all that and started focusing more on just trying to make music and, I remember taking a performance art class, and I kind of was applying performance art process to how I kind of applied that to my weird punk rock appearance. So, you know, walking down the street, I kind of used this really confrontational appearance to make people have to deal with me. Like, if I'm walking down the street and, you know, people, I got a blue mohawk and I got a skull with t-shirt or a t-shirt with skulls all over it and, you know, big boots. And at the time, you know, Green Day hadn't broken yet. So moms and dads across the nation didn't think green mohawks were cute, you know? And so, you know, yeah, it was interesting. Like, I kind of used it as a litmus test for, you know, who is living a miserable life and who's not. Cause if I'm walking down the street and you look at me and you see my blue hair, my green hair, and you see that I'm expressing whatever the hell I happen to be expressing, and you're like, wow, that's awesome. That person's doing what they want to do, and they're expressing what they want to express, and they're just kind of being, you know, liberal with themselves that way. You know, people, you could see who is stoked, and then you can see the people who then conversely like to kind of look at a person that looks different like that and kind of project their own bullshit on them and make all kinds of gross assumptions about those people and are disgusted by those people. And I'm okay with that. You know what I mean? Like, I want them to have to confront that, or I did anyway, when that was my deal.
Well, to confront their preconceived notions.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, fucking, you know what? Make them have to wear it on their fucking faces. Bring it to the forefront of their thinking. You know, for the couple of minutes that they have to watch me walk by on the sidewalk.
Yeah, it seems like talking to you, though, would have, you know, disabused them of a lot of those notions.
Conceivably. I remember there was one guy who, actually, there were two gentlemen who at different times kind of approached me trying to figure out what the fuck was going on. One of them was at the Bob's Big Boy in Vienna, where me and my friends like to hang out. Some guy, I don't know what his deal was. He was in a suit. He was by himself. And he kind of just was like, why are you looking so confrontational? Like, why are you doing that? And at the time, I didn't have much of an articulate answer for him. I was probably wired on, caffeine and probably really, really stoned on weed and really didn't care to talk to the guy. So I wasn't exactly anything but rude to the guy, and I think I'm pretty sure I stuck him with the with my bill, and we split. There was another guy who kind of approached me outside this coffee shop that a friend of mine worked at, And he asked me about my tattoo I have on my arm that was probably the only tattoo I had on my arm at the time. It just says hate. And he asked me about it, and he was like, well, what do you hate? I was like, well, I hate racists, and I hate fascists, and I hate assholes and liars and people who take advantage of people, and I hate people that ask me stupid questions. And he just got all flustered, you know, and came back a couple of minutes later like, hey, well, I thought there were no stupid questions. And I was like, yeah, you're wrong. Yeah, you're wrong about that. Kind of took the wind out of his sails. But
yeah, for the most part, are definitely legitimate things to hate.
No, for sure. I think so. Like, that's why, I mean, people have asked me before why I don't cover it up. And it's a reminder that there are things worth despising in this world, like ideologies that are counter to, you know, human decency, you know, counter to people being allowed to be happy, fucking have clean water, to live some other way other than being, you know, some kind of slave, you know. It's, yeah.
back to the music for a second.
Oh, yeah.
So when you got more serious about music after after stopping taking the art classes,
yeah,
what did that look like? What happened, and how did the goons come together?
So I came back from college. A bunch of my friends, like two or three guys, had just graduated from high school that were friends of ours. And they wanted to start something, and I wanted to do something, and I actually started off playing the drums because nobody wanted to play the drums, and I was a terrible drummer. And we just wanted to have something to do, you know, like none of us were into sports, and you know, none of us wanted to, I don't know, focus on careers or anything crazy like that, like. We just wanted to make noise and smoke dope and hang out with our friends. And that was the big motivation, you know. And then when we started to really play more and people, you know, were excited that we were going to play and people were excited to come see us, it kind of changed my whole headspace about, you know, kind of everything else that I was doing in my life. Like, you know, at that age for me, you know, criminal activity was not weird or scary, or it was just something that we did. Like, we did criminal stupid shit all the time because that's what you do when you're young and you're dumb and you've got, you know, no investment in not doing these things. And so, the focusing on the band and having, you know, shows to look forward to that we were going to play was a reason to not do other stupid shit. Like, I need to make sure that I don't get arrested just so that, you know, I can play this show. I got to make sure that I don't, you know, do anything else stupid. I don't even know what, but, and so then, you know, we're focusing on the music, and the motivation there too was like, we want people to go apeshit. Like, that's what we want, is we want to have a room of people who cannot keep from fucking freaking out. We want every show to feel like it's a party. We want everybody to come together and have a good time. And it worked out that way, a lot. But not all the time, and so there were times where we did things like, well, we're not going to play in D.C. for a few months because, you know, oh, this one show, this kid got busted up and cut open with a broken bottle during our set. Like, I don't want that, you know, nobody wants that, and that was happening a lot in D.C. at the time. But, yeah, just wanted to play,
well,
man.
Where were you rehearsing?
We were rehearsing at the Goon House. I moved into a house in Arlington, and we and the Suspects and Lickety Split all were practicing out of the basement.
had we had Brian on the show a few episodes back from Lickety Split and from the Veil.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's just so cool, the crossover between different guys and different bands in the area. It's awesome to hear, you know, the cross-pollination that sort of happened around that time.
Yep. Like, you start a band breaks up, and then that band forms, like, three other bands, and they all start playing together, too. It's, and then, you know, you're going to see their bands. It felt like a good community at the time, you know, like, there were a lot of people who were excited. People were coming out to all the shows, you know, started playing at places like the Asylum, on U Street. And then when the Asylum closed down, we're playing, our guitar player was booking shows at that place, like every, I think, Thursday night or something like that. And so that place became this place where Jew is. Everybody knew that every Thursday at the Coffee House on U Street, there's going to be some kind of punk show going on. Like, they might not know who's playing, but they're going to show up anyway. You know?
And so what was the band's lineup at that time?
It was me and Mike Palmedo, and we went through a bunch of drummers, and TJ, who was in a band called Death Camp Skinny, he joined our band along with Death Camp Skinny's drummer for a short while. His name was Ben Bell. And then we had a second guitar player for a while who was Dave Prukop. And that was kind of like the core for a while. Was me, Mike, PJ, and Dave.
And how did you go through the process of recording your album?
So we really didn't know anything about recording. And you can definitely tell that's the case if you listen to our first 7-inch. But we kind of, so recording for us, you go into the studio, you set up all the equipment, and then the band plays all the songs a million times over, trying to get them as just right as they can. And then if you're going to do overdubs, the guitar player goes in and does some overdubs, and then the vocals go on top of all of that. And then we would come back like the next day or the next week, and we would mix everything, which is to me the most awful part of being in the studio ever, like having to listen to this one part of this one song over and over and over and over, trying to get everything blended and textured the way you want. And then by, you know, hour 6 or 7, it all just starts to sound like mud anyway. I hate that shit. Like that is, like, I love to have like recordings for people to have, because I love that they love it, and I love that they come out and they can sing along because they love it and they've been listening at home. But I hate the process, man. I would much rather just play live. Just play live all the time to tons of people and have a great time.
Not a studio rat.
Oh my god, no.
What was the studio, or what were each of the studios that you recorded each of your recordings at?
So the first 7-inch we did at Doug Kalmeyer's house. It was called the Stone House. It was in off of Franconia Road in Alexandria. And he was a sound guy at the Black Cat, and he still does sound for people. He's a really good bass player, too. And then the second recording we did, we put out a split 7-inch with these friends of ours from Philadelphia called the Boyles. And we recorded that at Inner Ear. And we had Kent Stacks come
come in and kind of help us out with the mixing and the sound, because I mean, he knows more about that shit than I do, and certainly did a better job. It sounds a lot better, let's say, for sure, than the first.
You live in a run around, let the bullshit hold you down. You run for cover around, next thing you know you're dead. What a destiny of the world, what a destiny of the world, what a destiny of the world, what a destiny of the world. Flashes of wasted time, things that never crossed your mind. You thought there'd be no regret, suckled off your TV set. What a destiny of the world, what a destiny of the world, what a destiny of the world, what a destiny of the world. Money on consumer slave,
then we went and recorded.
Wait, hold on one second. Was it exciting for you to record it in her ear?
Yeah. I mean, we grew up listening to all that Discord stuff, and we were kind of going for that in a way. Like, we were really – it's funny. Like, our bass player, he'll tell you that at the time we were trying to write early 80s style British punk rock, and really it came out sounding more like 80s LA hardcore, like
if you were into Fear, you know.
Yeah, for sure. I was very into fear. So I mean, that from my end, that makes sense. But you know, I don't play any of the instruments, and whereas I contribute a little bit to what happens to people's riffs when they bring them to the table, like, I certainly wasn't writing any of that stuff, you know. But I guess, it just worked out that way. But we kind of, you know, not knowing anything about recording, but knowing that studio would have an idea of what we're going for, we figured that was probably the thing to do. And we did it, and it was cool. We recorded most of our first CD there as well. And then we had a lineup change, and we wanted to record some songs with that lineup change. And we ended up going to a studio in the city that was run by Jeff Turner. I can't even remember what the name of the studio was. But then when we went back and re-recorded those songs at his studio, Brian Baker came, and Brian Baker was really helpful. And thankfully, you know, in addition to him being really helpful, you know, Jeff Turner took the recording special more seriously because he has respect for Brian Baker, and rightfully so. And that ended up being our first CD called Living in America. Came out in 97.
So thinking back on those CDs, what were like the songs that were breakthroughs for you?
So off that first CD, would have been Every Day. Like, that song, I mean, and this is going to sound totally weird and random, because it is, but 2 days ago when I was walking by my office around lunchtime, this guy who I assume some young homeless guy looked at me and started singing the lyrics to Every Day at me. And I talked to him for a minute, and that was totally weird, but that song seems to have stuck with people. Like, people still love that song.
I hate my job, I do it every day. The boss thinks it's stupid because I do things my way. I walk across the bridge, but I'm not in my shoes. I think I'm working, but I'm looking all the bad news. There's nothing gonna change, fuck the word. And this is the same, I went to gutter every day. I'm
second CD we recorded with this guy in Baltimore named Drew Masurek. And we got turned on to him by Rudy Costello, who ran a little punk rock supply store in Baltimore called Sticky Fingers. And he also did a record label. He hooked us up with Drew Masurek, and he put out our second CD, and it's called No Leaders. And on No Leaders, there's a song called White Tide. And people really, really dig that song, White Tide.
I love that song.
There you go. Perfect example. Yeah, people fucking love it. It's a great song. It is a lot of fun to perform. I really like that song. Third one's hard to say. I feel like so as we were getting older, the crowd kind of stays the same age, you know? And I feel like by the time Nation of Distress came out, which is our third CD, like we weren't as closely tied to our fan base socially as we had been before. So it's kind of hard to tell what song off of that, people really liked. I feel like I really like that record. Sometimes, it comes on random on my iPod, et cetera. And I just remember how great the guys that were in my band really were, I feel like they were fucking great writers and lots of fun.
Stop!
what happened to the band? What became the Begins? Because you guys are not still playing. When was the last time you played, and where has everybody gone?
So, we had a lot of lineup changes related to drummers, and a lot of just missed opportunities, it was just getting hard to slog through it. Financially the band was in debt, like $10,000. Our drummer at the time, he was having he was participating in some antisocial activities that were no good for him, unbeknownst to us. And, he was finding the pressure of having to perform a bunch, right? Cause I was kind of trying to get us on a schedule where we were playing enough to make enough money to put towards this $10,000 debt, to at least, make the minimum payment on the credit card, right? Which is, if you're playing in a punk rock band in DC, making a little bit of money is just like, wow, holy crap. Like we're kind of almost going to break even, maybe. And he couldn't deal with it anymore. And so he quit. When he told the rest of the guys that he was going to quit, the rest of them were just like, we don't want to train another drummer to play these songs again. So let's just call it a day. And so we did. And we'd been doing it for 12 years together. And, it was rough. It was fucking it felt like somebody died. I was like, holy shit, I've been doing this for so long and I've been focusing on this and I haven't been doing anything else. And then suddenly it's over. I'm like, ugh. That was 2006. So we played what was supposed to be our last show. We did a couple of reunion shows after that. I think we played like maybe four or five times after that. We opened up for the Dead Boys in November, I think, of last year. And we played a benefit show for a friend of ours from the scene who had gotten like a tumor in his inner ear. And so we did a benefit to help him out. And it was us and Government Issue. And I can't recall who else, because, man, who cares? It's us and Government Issue. Yeah! I think we played a show in Baltimore, like in late 2006. Like our buddy who ran the sidebar, he really wanted us to do a last Baltimore show, and that went okay. And we played with TSOL last year too in Baltimore. So yeah, I mean, every once in a while somebody calls us up.
I mean, those are some major bands: Dead Boys, TSOL. Government Issue, like those are all awesome groups.
Well, I mean, oh yeah, I mean that's why like, you know, somebody hits me up and goes, hey, do you want to play with TSOL? The answer is, fuck yes, we want to play with TSOL. And then I start calling the dudes going, hey man, get your shit together because we're going to practice so that we can play with TSOL. But I mean, we played with bands like that back in the day too. Like we played with Fear, we played with DI, played with Anti-Flag and UK Subs and, you know, we played with a ton of the band. Like I have this, this compilation that I got when I was 14 that is called, Band from the Pubs, right? And it's got all these UK bands, and we, like, I remember looking at them being like, wow, sweet, we played with these guys, we played with these guys, we played with these guys. It was fucking awesome. You know, played with fucking, played Holidays in the Sun in New Jersey that, you know, promised to be something spectacular and was, but, it was a fucking disaster. Like, the shows, the 3 days of shows were great. We played second to last on the last night after the Dead Kennedys played, and the place went from being, you know, I think it was like a capacity of like 2,000 people or something, down to 2 people watching us play. Because somebody thought it would be a great idea to schedule us after the Dead Kennedys. Oh, God. Yeah. And the club didn't help anything either. Somebody had lit a car on fire in the parking lot, and so everybody went outside to go look at that, and the club wouldn't let anybody back in. That whole, dude, I don't know if you heard about that festival, but it was fucking madness. Like, no. madness. There was it was Holidays in the Sun. It was like a Stone Pony, and across this big parking lot from the Stone Pony is this old beach hotel, right? Really fucking was fancy as fuck once upon a time. These fucking punk rock kids, man, it was the official hotel of the event, and they wrecked the place, just fucking wrecked the place. Like, the first night we went in there to visit some friends who had a hotel room, there were punk rock kids laying around on every piece of furniture, kids trying to get rooms that hadn't fucking bothered to make reservations and shit. Somebody broke the elevator. Somebody had thrown from like the 8th floor down the stairwell a fire hose and then tied it around one of the banisters on the 3rd floor into a knot. And then we went upstairs, we passed that. Somebody had shredded all this pornography all over the hallways. We had to watch some poor family trying to escape the insanity, like their kids having to walk past all that shit. Every floor, there's like a party going on. We go, we visit our buddies for a couple of minutes, come back downstairs. Somebody has turned the fire hose on. There's fucking water beating through that canvas. Like this is going to be fucking terrible. So we split and come back on Sunday, and like there's a police barricade in front of the hotel, and you have to prove that you have a hotel key to make it even up to the front door. It was nuts. Like something like 50 kids got arrested for squatting with different staff on the boardwalk because it was not summertime. Everything was closed, and kids needed a place to crash. So they're like breaking into all these abandoned places, trying to find, you know, trying to sleep someplace covered up and getting busted. It was nutty.
Sounds like quite the holiday.
Yeah, indeed. On the same weekend, like we went up Friday night to go see bands play, came home, played with the Misfits at Jack's in Springfield here, and then drove back up to play and watch bands on Sunday. It was a fun-filled weekend, to be sure.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, did you accomplish, like, all that you wanted to accomplish with the band? Are there, if not any regrets, I mean, are there any feelings about, you know, that you wish it had been, like, more successful in some ways?
I regret that we never got to go play in Europe. And, you know, but otherwise, I don't really regret the I don't know, man. I don't know. I'm struggling to answer this question because, you know, everybody gauges success differently, right? What we did, I feel was for us, or for me, it was a personal success in that we could go across the country and back, lose a bunch of money, but we could go to a town, a different town every day, hang out in front of a record store that, you know, we'd never been to, meet a bunch of random punk rocker kids from this other town, invite them to the show we're playing, party with them afterwards, you know, get to know a couple of really cool people that we never would have known otherwise, and have a great time, and then get in the van and drive to another town and do it again. And make it home, you know, and sleep on these people's floors and experience this kind of, this community, you know. People are feeding us. People are giving us places to crash. People are fucking wanting to have fun with us, you know. Like, I feel like that is hugely successful. Like, that felt great. You know, was there a part of me that wished that, gosh, maybe I could quit my real job and do this one day? Yeah, I'd much rather go do that every day than work at my real job. Who wouldn't? But I don't regret anything. You know, shit happens. It went the way it went, and I mean, if it was going to carry us elsewhere, it would have, and that's okay. If it did not.
So, are you playing in a band now?
Yeah. After the Goons broke up, I did not do any music for about 4 years. And then I did a band called Nervous Impulse, and we put out a 12-inch on Bridge Nine Records, and I really dig that record. We kind of broke up before it even came out. We still played some afterwards, but, you know, personality conflicts, et cetera. And then right now I'm doing a band with TJ, who was in the Goons, and this guy Jeff, who, have you ever heard of Two Men Advantage from Long Island?
No.
New York?
Yeah.
No? They are a very fun hockey-themed punk band. They're fucking great, and they're really great guys, too. And, you know, we played with them a whole bunch back in the day. And Jeff moved down here from New York, and, you know, he started playing bass with us. And the drummer is Ben. He was in a stoner metal band called Foe Hammer most recently. But Ben Blanton. Yes. He's playing drums with us, and yeah, we're writing stuff. We haven't come up with a name yet.
I love Ben, really, by the way.
Yeah, man, he's fucking great, dude. He's fucking great. Jeff's great. DJ's great. Like, I've known Ben for a million years, and I'm glad we get to play music together, because he is. I feel like there's a stoner metal influence to the music that I love and would like to be making that he gets, that a lot of the people that I've played music with don't quite get. Maybe it's because me and him both have smoked shit tons of weed in our lifetime. I don't know. But, yeah, I like to make music with that guy.
Yeah, I would love to hear that stuff and maybe get a chance to see you guys sometime.
Yeah, I'm hoping we'll be playing out soon. Like, we're close to having enough songs for a set. We just got to tighten it up and then come up with the name, the elusive, decent, fitting punk band name.
So, you know what we haven't talked about, though, is we haven't talked about your lyrics at all. And, you know, where that comes from and... You know, some about your politics and how that influences your lyrics.
Okay. Do you have specific questions about that you want to ask?
I kind of want to know where it comes from. You know, do you think it's the DC influence? Is it something more personal?
It's kind of both. My father was a translator for a international organization called the OAS that most Americans have never heard of. It's on 17th Street and Constitution in the city, and it is kind of like the UN, only they deal mostly with trade and they deal only with Western Hemisphere nations, right? And so early on, I had a little, I would hear murmurings of what was what, right? And then I also, I went to Catholic school, and I think I was one of three brown kids in my class. And so I kind of already felt kind of on the outside there. So kind of the alienated, angry, disenfranchised kind of vibe was always sort of there, because I don't buy into any of that Catholic school stuff. And so, you know, I was embattled there. I think I've always kind of been in this state of dissatisfaction. I was kind of sold these American ideals, and you know, the ideals really of taking care of each other and community, et cetera. But like, it's not practiced. It's all a fucking bunch of bullshit that they sell us, the bait and switch, you know, like buy into this and work really hard and you can, you know, be a fucking asshole too. Like, it's not true, you know. It's so not true, and they just want to, you know, motivate you to spin your wheels and make them money. And I was able to see that. And then, of course, you know, I'm listening to tons of punk rock, which is also pointing these things out to be. I was always really into 60s counterculture, which a lot of people think is weird because, you know, you always hear people be like, ooh, fuck hippies and fuck all that shit. Fuck that. Like, those people went and took to the streets and they fucking made some changes in our culture. They made some changes in our laws, you know, like they changed things and they influenced things. I know that hippies, et cetera, get portrayed in the media, et cetera, as moronic, stoned out idiots. And no doubt some of them were, but that is not what that was about. Just like the media focused on the violence and the nihilism of punk rock, like, yeah, that's there, but that's not everything it's about. And so, you know, I tried to kind of get out. If I'm going to perform on stage and I have this crazy, fast, energetic music, and I need to, you know, sing over this, I need to write lyrics that make me feel like this music sounds, that and that I can keep spitting out with the same kind of passion every time, with the same kind of conviction every time, because I believe it. And so we would write things. And, I mean, there's also tons of stuff that was just stupid, like, you know, people really like this song Mall Attack that's on our first CD, and it's like some stupid song that we wrote frustrated leaving, you know, I think we went to go see Natural Born Killers, and I came out of Natural Born Killers like, ah, if I was going to fucking go on a kill crazy rampage, I would start at the mall. You know what I mean? Like that, like just stupid antisocial shit that I needed to express along with stuff that was just frustrations with, you know, the hypocrisy of our fucking culture and the hypocrisy of fucking our teachers and the hypocrisy of our politicians. It's just, it's disgusting. And you know, the people have been yelling about this shit forever, and it doesn't seem to do any good. It's kind of, it's disheartening and sad, but you know, sometimes all you can do is keep on fucking screaming. You know what I mean? Like, scream your truth and hopefully somebody will hear you and somebody will fucking do, will change something for themselves, you know?
You must have a lot to scream about right now.
I do. I've been kind of having a hard time tapping into it. I'm a very different person than I was in my youth, and currently things are just fucking, I mean, I'm sure you've heard plenty of people express this just disbelief of, like, it can't be, like, what kind of weird parallel universe have we fucking slipped into where this is what's fucking going on here? You know, I wrote a song for Nervous Impulse called Build a Bomb or Shut Up, and it's a song about myself and my own headspace and the idea that, like, you know, sometimes about some of these things I can sit here and I can bitch, or I can go build a bomb. Productive in either of those things, and so it's either I shut up or I, you know, wage a war somehow, and I can't find, I'm having a hard time right now tapping into that fucking rage, because I feel like it will go too far, and I don't want to go to these horrible ugly places. We're in a horrible ugly place. But I got to do it. So it's going to happen.
How do you find you keep it going? Like you are able to sustain yourself kind of as you age, you know, getting on stage and doing it up there. You know, and versus like when, you know, you were in high school or when you were a kid.
So I did it for 12 years straight, you know, it's all like when we go and we play Goon songs, it's pure muscle memory and it just happens and it happens the way it's supposed to happen. It's, so some people I think, get kind of confused about what it's like to get up on stage. For some people, they're really self-conscious, and they have, you know, a routine that they're doing, you know. And whereas we have a set list, and I know that these are the songs I'm going to sing, and these are the lyrics I'm going to be spitting out, it's all real free form for me up there. You know, I'm trying to connect with these people, and I'm fucking looking at them, and I am imploring them to hear me and hear what I'm saying. It's really not as hard as people think. It's that step you got to take to where you let go of the self-consciousness and you just do, that a lot of people can't make happen for themselves. But that, when you are, spend your whole life telling people to go fuck themselves because you're going to do what you want to do, and that's just how it is, it gets a lot easier. Like, I mean, really, like, if I go up there and I flub, who the fuck gives a shit, man? I've done it a million times, gone up on stage and flubbed, and the people don't notice. Like, people, when you're performing, you are more aware of your mistakes than the people in the crowd are. And so there's no point in dwelling on them or worrying about them. It's just fucking do it and have a great time.
So, to wrap up, let me just ask you, do you consider yourself a DC punk or a Northern Virginia punk?
if you
had to choose.
If I had to choose, I would call myself a DC punk. I spent more of my time being a punk rock kid hanging out in the city than I did hanging out in the suburbs. And I went to more shows in the city, and I met fucking more people in the city and had more of a good time in the city.
What did the Virginia suburbs, how did they influence your music, you think?
I moved to Maryland. You know what I mean? Like, that's how that shit works. Like, I said, fuck this. You know what it was? It was like being behind enemy lines. You know, there's people who are like, oh, gross, you live in D.C. and all those uptight people. And, like, I have all these friends and these people that I love that live in Baltimore, and they're like, fuck D.C., we hate D.C. And I get why they say, fuck D.C., we hate D.C., it's full of uptight assholes, because it is. It's full of uptight assholes and lawyers and fucking, it's fucking, sometimes it's really gross. But in there are fucking great people, too, and you have a clear reminder of what you are personally, you know, fighting against socially, politically. It's all right there, you know.
Listen, man, I know you didn't want to do a long interview, and I know you've got a lawn to mow.
I have no problem doing a long interview, clearly. I will run my mouth as long as you let me do it.
I've loved it, though, man. This has been great. I really enjoyed talking to you and hearing about all of this. Great to talk.
Thank you.
Great to meet
you. Great talking to you.
And I look forward to hearing from you soon.
Bye.